This is Audible.
It's Kind of a Funny Story by Ned Vizzini. Narrated by Robert Fass. Copyright 2006 by Ned Vizzini. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Ned Vizzini, care of William Morris Endeavor Entertainment, LLC, and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto.
Part 1. Where I'm At. Chapter 1. It's so hard to talk when you want to kill yourself. That's above and beyond everything else, and it's not a mental complaint. It's a physical thing, like it's physically hard to open your mouth and make the words come out. They don't come out smooth and in conjunction with your brain the way normal people's words do. They come out in chunks, as if from a crushed ice dispenser. You stumble on them as they gather behind your lower lip, so you just keep quiet. Have you ever noticed how on all the ads on TV, people are watching TV? My friend is like. Pass it, son, my other friend is like. No, yo, that's true, my other friend is like. There's always somebody on a couch, unless it's an allergy ad and they're in a field. Or on a horse on the beach. Those ads are always for herpes. Laughter. How do you even tell someone you have that? That's Aaron. It's his house. That must be such a weird conversation. Hey, before we do this, you should know. Your mom's didn't mind last night. Oh! Son! Aaron lobs a punch at Ronnie, the antagonist. Ronnie is small and wears jewelry. He once told me, Craig, when a man puts on his first piece of jewelry, there's no turning back. He punches back with his hand with the big limp gold bracelet on it. It hits Aaron's watch, clanging. Son, what you trying to do with my gold, yo? Ronnie shakes his wrist and turns his attention to the pot. There's always pot at Aaron's house. He has a room with an entirely separate ventilation system and lockable door that his parents could rent out as another apartment. Resin streaks outline his light switch, and his bedsheet is pockmarked with black circles. There are stains on there, too. Shimmery stains which indicate certain activities that take place between Aaron and his girlfriend. I look at them, the stains, then the couple. I'm jealous. But then again, I'm beyond jealous.
Craig, you want?
It's passed to me, wrapped up in a concise delivery system, but I pass it on. I'm doing an experiment with my brain. I'm seeing if maybe pot is the problem. Maybe that's what has come in and robbed me. I do this every so often, for a few weeks, and then I smoke a lot of pot, just to test if maybe the lack of it is what has robbed me. You all right, man? This should be my name. I could be like a superhero. You all right, man? I stumble.
Don't bug Craig, Ronnie is like. He's in the Craig zone. He's Craiging out.
Yeah. I move the muscles that make me smile. I'm just kind of... You know, you see how the words work? They betray your mouth and walk away. Are you okay? Nia asks. Nia is Aaron's girlfriend. She's in physical contact with Aaron at all times. Right now she's on the floor next to his leg. She has big eyes. I'm fine, I tell her. The blue glow of the flat-screen TV in front of us ricochets off her eyes as she turns back to it. We're watching a nature special on the deep ocean.
Holy shit, look at that, son,
Ronnie is like, blowing smoke. I don't know how it got back to him already. There's an octopus on the screen with giant ears, translucent, flapping through the water in the cold light of a submersible.
Scientists have playfully named this specimen Dumbo, the TV narrator says.
I smile to myself. I have a secret. I wish I was Dumbo the octopus. Adapted to freezing deep ocean temperatures, I'd flop around down there at peace. The big concerns of my life would be what sort of bottom-coating slime to feed off of. That's not so different from now. Plus, I wouldn't have any natural predators. Then again, I don't have any now, and that hasn't done me a whole lot of good. But it suddenly makes sense. I'd like to be under the sea as an octopus. I'll be back, I say, getting up from my spot on the couch, which Scruggs, a friend who was relegated to the floor, immediately claims, slinking up in one fluid motion.
You didn't call 1-5, he's like.
1-5? I try.
Too late.
I shrug and climb over clothes and people's legs to the beige apartment front door-style door. I move through that to the right, Aaron's warm bathroom.
I have a system with bathrooms. I spend a lot of time in them. They're sanctuaries, public places of peace spaced throughout the world for people like me. When I pop into Aaron's, I continue my normal routine of wasting time. I turn the light off first, then I sigh. Then I turn around, face the door I just closed, pull down my pants, and fall on the toilet. I don't sit. I fall like a carcass, feeling my butt accommodate the rim. Then I put my head in my hands and breathe out as I, well, you know, piss. I always try to enjoy it, to feel it come out and realize that it's my body doing something it has to do, like eating, although I'm not too good at that. I bury my face in my hands and wish that it could go on forever, because it feels good. You do it and it's done. It doesn't take any effort or any planning. You don't put it off. That would be really screwed up, I think, if you had such problems that you didn't pee. Like being anorexic except with urine. If you held it in as self-punishment. I wonder if anyone does that. I finish up and flush, reaching behind me, my head still down. Then I get up and turn on the light. Did anyone notice I was in here in the dark? Did they see the lack of light under the crack and notice it like a roach? Did Nia see? Then I look in the mirror. I look so normal. I look like I've always looked, like I did before the fall of last year. Dark hair and dark eyes and one snaggled tooth. Big eyebrows that meet in the middle. A long nose, sort of twisted. Pupils that are naturally large, it's not the pot, which blend into the dark brown to make two big saucer eyes, holes in me. Wisps of hair above my upper lip. This is Craig. And I always look like I'm about to cry. I put on the hot water and splash it at my face to feel something. In a few seconds I'm going to have to go back and face the crowd. But I can sit in the dark on the toilet a little more, can't I? I always manage to make a trip to the bathroom take 5 minutes. Chapter 2. How are you doing? Dr. Minerva asks. Her office has a bookshelf, like all shrinks' offices. I used to not want to call them shrinks, but now that I've been through so many, I feel entitled to it. It's an adult term, and it's disrespectful, and I'm more than two-thirds adult, and I'm pretty disrespectful, so what the hell? Like all shrinks' offices, anyway, it has the bookshelf full of required reading. First of all, there's the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which lists every kind of psychological disorder known to man. That's fun reading. Very thick book. I don't have a whole lot of what's in there. I just have one big thing. But I know all about it from skimming. There's great stuff in there. There's a disease called Undine's Curse, in which your body loses the ability to breathe involuntarily. Can you imagine? You have to think, breathe, breathe all the time, or you stop breathing. Most people who get it die. If the shrink is classy, she'll, mostly she'll, occasionally a he'll, have a bunch of DSMs, because they come in different editions. 3, 4, and 5 are the most common. I don't think you can find a DSM-2. It came out in 1963 or something. It takes like 10 years to put one out, and they're working on 6. Jeez, I could be a shrink. Now, in addition to the DSMs, there are an assortment of specific books on psychiatric disorders. Things like the Freedom from Depression Workbook, Anxiety and Panic Attacks, Their Cause and Cure, and The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Always hardcover, no paperbacks in a shrink's office. Usually there's at least one book on childhood sexual abuse, like The Wounded Heart. And one shrink I went to caught me looking at that and said, "That book is about childhood sexual abuse." And I was like, "Uh-huh." And she said, "It's for people who were abused." And I nodded. "Were you?" She had a little old lady face, this one, with a shock of white hair, and I never saw her again. What kind of question was that? Of course I wasn't abused. If I were, things would be so simple. I'd have a reason for being in shrink's offices. I'd have a justification and something that I could work on.
The world wasn't going to give me something that tidy.
I'm fine. Well, I'm not fine. I'm here.
Is there something wrong with that?
Absolutely. You've been coming here for a while.
Dr. Minerva always has such amazing outfits. It's not that she's particularly sexy or beautiful. She just carves herself out well. Today she has a red sweater and red lipstick that is exactly the same red. It's as if she went to the paint store to match them up.
I want to not have to come here.
Well, you're in a process. How are you doing?
This is her prompt question. The shrinks always have one prompt question. I've had ones that said, "What's up? How are we?" And even, "What's happening in the world of Craig?" They never change. It's like their jingle.
I didn't wake up well today.
Did you sleep well?
I slept okay.
She looks completely stone, staring ahead. I don't know how they do this, the psych poker face. Psychologists should play poker. Maybe they do. Maybe they're the ones who win all the money on TV. Then they have the gall to charge my mom $120 an hour.
They're very greedy.
What happened when you woke up?
I was having a dream. I don't know what it was, but when I woke up, I had this awful realization that I was awake. It hit me like a brick in the groin.
Like a brick in the groin, I see.
I didn't want to wake up. I was having a much better time asleep. And that's really sad. It was almost like a reverse nightmare, like when you wake up from a nightmare, you're so relieved. I woke up into a nightmare.
And what is that nightmare, Craig?
Life.
Life is a nightmare.
Yes.
We stop.
Cosmic moment, I guess.
Ooh, is life really a nightmare? We need to spend like 10 seconds contemplating that.
What did you do when you realized you were awake?
I lay in bed.
There were more things to tell her, things I held back, like the fact that I was hungry in bed this morning. I hadn't eaten the night before. I went to bed exhausted from homework and knew as I hit the pillow that I would pay for it in the morning, that I would wake up really hungry, that I would cross the line where my stomach gets so needy that I can't eat anything. I woke up and my stomach was screaming, hollowing itself out under my little chest. I didn't want to do anything about it. I didn't want to eat. The idea of eating made me hurt more. I couldn't think of anything, not one single solitary food item that I would be able to handle, except coffee yogurt, and I was sick of coffee yogurt. I rolled over on my stomach and balled my fists and held them against my gut like I was praying. The fists pushed my stomach against itself and fooled it into thinking it was full. I held this position, warm, my brain rotating, the seconds whirring by. Only the pure urge, the one thing that never let me down, got me out of bed 50 minutes later. I got up when I had to piss.
I see.
That was great.
You like peeing. You've mentioned this before.
Yeah, it's simple.
You like simple.
Doesn't everybody?
Some people thrive on complexity, Craig.
Well, not me. As I was walking over here, I was thinking, I have this fantasy of being a bike messenger.
Ah.
It would be so simple and direct, and I would get paid for it. It would be an anchor.
What about school, Craig? You have school for an anchor.
School is too all over the place. It spirals out into a million different things.
Your tentacles.
I have to hand it to her. Dr. Minerva picked up on my lingo pretty quickly. Tentacles is my term. The tentacles are the evil tasks that invade my life. Like, for example, my American history class last week, which necessitated me writing a paper on the weapons of the Revolutionary War, which necessitated me traveling to the Metropolitan Museum to check out some of the old guns, which necessitated me getting in the subway, which necessitated me being away from my cell phone and email for 45 minutes, which meant that I didn't get to respond to a mass mail sent out by my teacher asking who needed extra credit, which meant other kids snapped up the extra credit, which meant I wasn't going to get a 98 in the class, which meant I wasn't anywhere close to a 98.6 average. Body temperature, that's what you needed to get. Which meant I wasn't going to get into a good college, which meant I wasn't going to have a good job, which meant I wasn't going to have health insurance, which meant I'd have to pay tremendous amounts of money for the shrinks and drugs my brain needed, which meant I wasn't going to have enough money to pay for a good lifestyle, which meant I'd feel ashamed, which meant I'd get depressed. And that was the big one. because I knew what that did to me. It made it so I wouldn't get out of bed, which led to the ultimate thing, homelessness. If you can't get out of bed for long enough, people come and take your bed away. The opposite of the tentacles are the anchors. The anchors are things that occupy my mind and make me feel good temporarily. Riding my bike is an anchor. Doing flashcards is an anchor. Watching people play video games at errands is an anchor. The answers are simple and sequential. There aren't any decisions. There aren't any tentacles. There's just a stack of tasks that you tackle. You don't have to deal with other people. There are a lot of tentacles, I admit, but I should be able to handle them. The problem is that I'm so lazy.
How are you lazy, Craig?
I waste at least an hour every day lying in bed. Then I waste time pacing. I waste time thinking. I waste time being quiet and not saying anything because I'm afraid I'll stutter.
Do you have a problem with stuttering?
When I'm depressed, it won't come out right. I'll trail off in mid-sentence.
I see.
She writes something down on her legal pad. Craig, this will go on your permanent record.
I shake my head. The bike thing. What? What were you going to say?
This is another trick of shrinks. They never let you stop in mid-thought. If you open your mouth, they want to know exactly what you had the intention of saying. The party line is that some of the most profound truths about us are things that we stop saying in the middle. But I think they do it to make us feel important. One thing's for sure. No one else in my life says to me, "Wait, Craig, what were you going to say?" I was going to say that I don't think the stuttering is like a real problem. I just think it's one of my symptoms.
Like sweating.
Right. The sweating is awful. It's not as bad as the not eating, but it's weird. Cold sweat all over my forehead, having to be wiped off every 2 minutes, smelling like skin concentrate. People notice. It's one of the few things people notice.
You're not stuttering now.
This is being paid for. I don't want to waste time.
Pause.
Now we have one of our silent battles. I look at Dr. Minerva, and she looks at me. It's a contest as to who will crack first. She puts on her poker face. I don't have any extra faces to put on, just the normal Craig face. We lock eyes. I'm waiting for her to say something profound. I always am, even though it'll never happen. I'm waiting for her to say, "Craig, what you need to do is X," and for the shift to occur. I want there to be a shift so bad. I want to feel my brain slide back into the slot it was meant to be in, rest there the way it did before the fall of last year, back when I was young and witty, and my teachers said I had incredible promise, and I had incredible promise, and I spoke up in class because I was excited and smart about the world. I want the shift so bad. I'm waiting for the phrase that will invoke it. It'll be like a miracle within my life. But is Dr. Minerva a miracle worker? No. She's a thin, tan lady from Greece with red lipstick. She breaks first.
About your bike riding, you said you wanted to be a messenger?
Yes.
You already have a bike, correct?
Yes.
And you ride it a lot?
Not that much. Mom won't let me ride it to school. But I ride around Brooklyn on weekends.
What does it feel like when you ride your bike, Craig?
I pause.
Geometric.
Geometric? Yeah, like, you have to avoid this truck. Don't get hit in the head by these metal pipes. Make a right. The rules are defined and you follow them.
Like a video game.
Sure, I love video games, even just to watch, since I was a kid.
Which you often refer to as back when you were happy.
Right. I smooth my shirt out. I get dressed up for these little meetings, too. Good khakis and a white dress shirt. We're dressing up for each other. We should really go get some coffee and make a scandal. The Greek therapist and her high school boyfriend. We could be famous. That would get me money. That might make me happy.
Do you remember some of the things that made you happy?
The video games. I laugh.
What's funny?
I was walking down my block the other day, and behind me was a mother with her kid, and the mother was saying, "Now, Timmy, I don't want you to complain about it. You can't play video games 24 hours a day." And Timmy goes, "But I want to." And I turned around and told him, "Me too."
You want to play video games 24 hours a day? Or watch? I just want to not be me. Whether it's sleeping or playing video games or riding my bike or studying, giving my brain up, that's what's important.
You're very clear about what you want.
Yeah.
What did you want when you were a kid? Back when you were happy. What did you want to be when you grew up?
Dr. Minerva is a good shrink, I think. That isn't the answer, but it is a damn good question. What did I want to be when I grew up?
Chapter 3.
When I was 4, this is how things were. Our family lived in a crappy apartment in Manhattan. I didn't know it was crappy at the time, because I didn't have our better apartment to compare it to yet. But there was exposed piping. That's no good. You don't want to raise your child in a house with exposed piping. I remember there was a green pipe and a red pipe and a white pipe, gathered near the corner of the hallway just before the bathroom, and as soon as I could walk, I investigated them all, walked up to them and put my palm about 2 millimeters away from each one to test if it was hot or cold. One was cold, one was hot, and the red one was really hot. 2 millimeters wasn't enough. I burned myself on it, and Dad, who hadn't realized it must only get hot in the afternoon, encased it in dark gray foam with duct tape. But duct tape never stopped me, and I thought the foam was fun to pick at and chew. So I picked it off and chewed it, and then when other kids came over to my house, I dared them to touch the re-exposed pipe. I told them anyone who came in had to touch it, otherwise they were a pussy, which was a word I learned from Dad watching TV, which I thought was great because it was a word with two meanings, the cat that girls liked and the thing you called people to make them do stuff. Just like chicken had two meanings, the bird that walked around and the white stuff you ate. Some people touched the hot pipe if you called them chicken as well. I had my own room, but I didn't like to be alone in it. The only room I liked to be in was the living room, under the table that held all the encyclopedias. I made it my little fort. I put a blanket over me and worked in there, with a light that Dad rigged up. I worked on maps. I loved maps. I knew that we lived in Manhattan, and I had a map of it, a Hagstrom 5-borough atlas with all the streets laid out. I knew exactly where we lived, on the corner of 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue. 3rd Avenue was a yellow street because it was an avenue, big and long and important. 53rd Street was a little white street that went across Manhattan. The streets went sideways and the avenues went up and down. That was all you had to remember. Dad helped me remember, too, when we went out for pancakes. He would ask, "Do you want them cut in streets and avenues, Craig?" And I'd go, "Yes." And he'd cut the stack of pancakes in a grid, and we'd name each street and avenue as we went along, making sure to get 3rd Avenue and 53rd Street. It was so simple. If you were really advanced, like I was, duh, you knew that traffic on the even streets went east, east for even, and the odd streets went west, west is odd. Then every bunch of streets, there were fat yellow streets, like the avenues, that went both ways. These were the famous streets. 42nd Street, 34th Street. The complete list from the bottom up was Chambers Street, Canal Street, Houston Street, 14th Street, 23rd Street, 34th Street, 42nd Street, 57th Street, 72nd Street. There wasn't any big street in the 60s. They got shafted. 79th Street, 86th Street, 96th Street, and then you were in Harlem, where Manhattan effectively ended for little white boys who made forts under encyclopedias and studied maps. As soon as I saw the Manhattan map, I wanted to draw it. I should be able to draw the place where I lived. So I asked Mom for tracing paper, and she got it for me, and I brought it into my fort, and I pointed the light right down on the first map in the Hagstrom Atlas, downtown, where Wall Street was and the stock market worked. The streets were crazy down there. They didn't have any kind of streets and avenues. They just had names, and they looked like a game of pickup sticks. But before I could even worry about the streets, I had to get the land right. Manhattan was actually built on land. Sometimes when they were digging up the streets, you saw it down there, real dirt. And the land had a certain curve to it at the bottom of the island, like a dinosaur head, bumpy on the right and straight on the left, a swooping, majestic bottom. I held my tracing paper down and tried to trace the line of Lower Manhattan. I couldn't do it. I mean, it was ridiculous. My line didn't have anything to do with the real one. I didn't understand. I was holding the tracing paper steady. I looked at my small hand. "Stay still," I told it. I crumpled up the paper and tried again. The line wasn't right again. It didn't have the swoop. I crumpled up the paper and tried again. This line was even worse than before. Manhattan looked square. I tried again. Oh, boy, now it looked like a duck. Crumple. Now it looked like a turd, another word I picked up from Dad. Crumple. Now it looked like a piece of fruit. It looked like everything but what it was supposed to look like, Manhattan. I couldn't do it. I didn't realize then that when you trace stuff, you're supposed to have a tracing table lighted from below and clamps to hold the paper straight, not a trembling 4-year-old hand. So I just thought I was a failure. They always said on TV you could do anything you wanted, but here I was trying to do something and it wasn't working. I would never be able to do it. I crumpled up the last piece of tracing paper and started sobbing, my head in my hands in my fort. Mom heard me. "Craig?"
"What? Go away."
"What's wrong, honey?"
"Don't open the curtain. Don't open it. I have things in here."
"Why are you crying? What's the matter?"
"I can't do it."
"What's the matter?"
"Nothing."
"Tell Mommy. Come on. I'm going to open the blanket."
"No!"
I jumped at her face as she pulled the blanket aside, bringing it taut under the encyclopedias. Mom threw her hands up and held the books in place, saving both of us from getting clobbered. A week later, she'd have Dad move the encyclopedias. With her occupied, I ran across the room, streaking tears, wanting to get to the bathroom, to sit down on the toilet with the light off and splash hot water on my face. But Mom was too quick. She shoved the encyclopedias back and loped across the room, swooping me up in her thin arms with the elbow skin that you could pull down. I beat my palms against her.
"Craig, we do not hit Mommy." "I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it!"
I hit her.
"What?"
She hugged me tight so I had no room to hit.
"What can't you do?" "I can't draw Manhattan."
"Huh?" Mom drew her face up and away from me, looked me in the eyes.
"Is that what you were trying to do down there?"
I nodded, sniffled.
"You were trying to trace Manhattan with the tracing paper I bought you?"
"I can't do it."
"Craig, no one can."
She laughed.
"You can't just trace freehand. It's impossible."
"Then how do they make the maps?" Mom paused.
"See? See? Someone can do it."
"They have equipment, Craig. They're grown-ups and they have special tools that they use."
"Well, I need those tools."
"Craig."
"Let's buy them."
"Honey."
"Do they cost a lot of money?"
"Honey." Mom put me down on the sofa, which turned into a bed for her and Dad at night, and sat next to me. I wasn't crying anymore. I wasn't hitting anymore. My brain was all right back then. It didn't get stuck in ruts.
"Craig,"
she sighed, looked at me. "I have an idea. Instead of spending your time trying to trace maps of Manhattan, why don't you make your own maps of imaginary places?" And that was the closest I've ever come to an epiphany. I could make up my own city. I could use my own streets. I could put a river where I wanted. I could put the ocean where I wanted. I could put the bridges where I wanted, and I could put a big highway right across the middle of town, like Manhattan should have but didn't. I could make my own subway system. I could make my own street names. I could have my own grid stretching off to the edges of the map. I smiled and hugged Mom. She got me some thick paper. White construction paper. Later on, I grew to prefer straight computer paper. I went back under my fort and turned the light on and started on my first map. And I did that for the next 5 years. Whenever I was in class, I didn't doodle. I drew maps, hundreds of them. When I finished, I crumpled them. It was making them that was important. I did cities on the ocean, cities with two rivers meeting in the middle, cities with one big river that bent, cities with bridges, crazy interchanges, circles, and boulevards. I made cities. That made me happy. That was my anchor. And until I turned 9 and turned to video games,
That was what I wanted to be when I grew up, a map maker.
Chapter 4. I wanted to make maps, I tell Dr. Minerva.
Maps of what?
Cities.
On the computer?
No, by hand.
I see.
I don't think there's much of a market for that, I smile.
Maybe not, maybe so.
What a shrink answer.
I can't take maybes. I have to make money.
We're going to talk more about money next time. We have to stop now.
I look at the clock.
7:03. She always gives an extra 3 minutes.
What are you going to do when you leave, Craig?
She always asks that. What am I always going to do? I'm going to go home and freak out. I'm going to sit with my family and try not to talk about myself and what's wrong. I'm going to try and eat. Then I'm going to try and sleep. I dread it. I can't eat and I can't sleep. I'm not doing well in terms of being a functional human, you know?
Hey, soldier, what's the matter?
I can't sleep and I can't eat, sir.
How about I pump you full of lead, soldier? Would that get you motivated?
Can't say, sir. I'd probably still be unable to sleep or eat, just a little bit heavier from the lead.
Get up there and fight, soldier. The enemy is there.
The enemy is too strong. I can't fight them. They're too smart.
You're smart too, soldier.
Not smart enough.
So you're just going to give up?
That's the plan. I'm going to just keep at it, I tell Dr. Minerva. That's all I can do. I'll keep at it and hope it gets better.
Are you taking your medicine?
Yes.
Are you seeing Dr. Barney?
Dr. Barney is the psychopharmacologist. He's the one who prescribes me meds and sends me to people like Dr. Minerva. He's a trip in his own way, a little fat Santa with rings embedded in his fingers.
Yes, later in the week. You know to do what he says.
Yes, doctor, I'll do what you say. I'll do what you all say.
Here. I hand Dr. Minerva the check from my mom.
Chapter 5. My family shouldn't have to put up with me. They're good people. Solid. Happy. Sometimes when I'm with them, I think I'm on television. We live in an apartment. A much better one than the Manhattan one. But still not good enough. Not something to be proud of. In Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a big, fat blob with its own ugly shape across from Manhattan. It looks like Jabba the Hutt counting his money. Its bridges connect to Manhattan, and it's split up by canals and creeks, filthy green streaks of water that remind you that it used to be a swamp. There are brownstones, limestone and maroon houses that stand like fence posts and always have Indian men refurbishing them, and everybody goes crazy for those, pays millions of dollars to live in them. But other than that, it's a pretty statusless place. It's a shame we moved out of Manhattan, where all the real people with power live. The walk from Dr. Minerva's office to our apartment is a short one, but loaded with mocking stores. Food stores. The absolute worst part of being depressed is the food. A person's relationship with food is one of their most important relationships. I don't think your relationship with your parents is that important. Some people never know their parents. I don't think your relationships with your friends are important. But your relationship with air, that's key. You can't break up with air. You're kind of stuck together. Only slightly less crucial is water. And then food. You can't be dropping food to hang with someone else. You need to strike up an agreement with it. I never liked eating the traditional American things. Pork chops, steak, rack of lamb. I still don't. Never mind vegetables. I used to like the foods that come in abstract shapes. Chicken nuggets, fruit roll-ups, hot dogs. I liked junk food. I could demolish a bag of cheese doodles. I'd have doodle cheese so far infused into my fingertips I'd be tasting it on myself for a day. And so I had a good thing going with food. I thought about it the way everyone else did. When you're hungry, you have some. Then last fall happened, and I stopped eating. Now I get mocked by these groceries, pizza places, ice cream stores, delis, Chinese places, bakeries, sushi joints, McDonald's's. They sit out in the street pushing what I can't enjoy. My stomach shrank or something. It doesn't take in much.
and if I force in a certain amount, it rejects everything, sends me to the bathroom to vomit in the dark. It's like a gnawing, the tug of a rope wrapped around the end of my esophagus. There's a man down there, and he wants food, but the only way he knows to ask for it is to tug on the rope, and when he does, it closes up the entrance so I can't put anything in. If he would just relax, let the rope go, I'd be able to give him all the food he wanted. But he's down there making me dizzy and tired, giving extra tugs as I pass restaurants that smell like fat and grease. When I do eat, it's one of two experiences, a battle or a slaughter. When I'm bad, when the cycling is going on in my brain, it's a battle. Every bite hurts. My stomach wants no part of it. Everything is forced. The food wants to stay on the plate, and once it's inside me, it wants to get back on the plate. People give me strange looks. What's wrong, Craig? Why aren't you eating? But then there are moments when it comes together. The shift hasn't happened yet. Maybe it never will. But sometimes, just enough times to give me hope, my brain jars back into where it's supposed to be. When I feel one of these, I call them the fake shifts. I should always eat, although I don't. I sometimes stubbornly, foolishly try to hold the feeling and get things done while my mind can operate and neglect to eat, and then I'm back where I started. But oh, when I slip back into being okay when I'm around food, watch out. It's all going in. Eggs and hamburgers and fries and ice cream and marmalade and fruity pebbles and cookies and broccoli even, and noodles and sauce. Screw you. I'm going to eat all of you. I'm Craig Gilner, and I will make myself strong from you. I don't know when my body chemistry is going to line up to let me eat again, so you are all getting in me right now. And that feels so good. I eat it all, and the man is away from his rope. He's busy down there eating everything that falls inside, running around like a chicken with its head cut off, the head on the floor munching food of its own. All my cells take the food in, and they love it, and they love my brain for it, and I smile, and I'm full. I'm full and functional, and I can do anything. And once I eat, this is the amazing part, once I eat, I sleep. I sleep like I should, like a hunter who just brought home a kill. But then I wake up, and the man is back, my stomach is tight, and I don't know what it was that got me to have a slaughter eating experience. It's not pot. It's not girls. It's not my family. I've started to think it must just be chemistry, in which case we're looking for the shift, and we haven't found it yet. Chapter 6. Night is here, except for a thin gray at the edge of the sky, and the trees are thick with rain, and the drizzle is pissing on me as I come up to my house. No sunsets in spring. I lean in and ring the buzzer. Streaked bronze from years of use, the most used buzzer in the building.
Craig?
Hi, Mom.
Bzzzt.
It growls deeply, amplified by the lobby. Lobby, mailroom more like, just a compartment for mailboxes. I throw open one door and then the other. It's warm in the house, and it smells like cooked starch. The dogs greet me.
Hi, Rudy. Hi, Jordan.
They're little dogs. My sister named them. She's 9. Rudy is a mutt. My father says he's a cross between a Chihuahua and a German Shepherd, which must have been some wild dog sex. I hope the German Shepherd was the guy. Otherwise the German Shepherd girl probably wasn't too satisfied. Rudy has a pronounced underbite. He looks like two dogs where one is eating the other's head from below. But when I take him for a walk, girls love him and talk to me. Then they realize that I'm young and or messed up, and they move on. Jordan, a Tibetan spaniel, looks like a small brown lion. He's small and cute, but completely crazy. His breed was devised in Tibet for the purpose of guarding monasteries. When he came into our home, he immediately fixated on the house as a monastery, the bathroom as the most sacred monastic cell, and my mom as the abbess. You can't go near my mother without Jordan protecting her. When she's in the bathroom in the morning, Jordan has to be in there with her, placed up on the counter by the sink as she brushes her teeth. Jordan barks at me. Since I started losing it, he started barking at me.
It's not something any of us mention.
Craig, how is Dr. Minerva?
Mom comes out of the kitchen. She's still tall and skinny, looking better each year. I know that's weird to think, but what the hell? She's just a woman who happens to be my mom. It's amazing how she looks more stately and confident as she gets older. I've seen pictures of her in college, and she didn't look like much. Dad is looking like he made a better decision every year.
It was okay.
I hug her. She's taken such good care of me since I got bad. I owe her everything, and I love her, and I tell her these days, although every time I say it, it gets a little diluted. I think you run out of I love yous.
Are you still happy with her?
Yeah.
Because if you're not, we'll get you someone else.
You can't afford to get anyone else, I think, looking at the crack in the wall next to my mom. This crack in our front hallway has been there for 3 or 4 years. Dad paints over it, and it just re-cracks. We've tried putting a mirror over it, but it's a strange place to put a mirror, on one side of a hallway. And my sister started calling it the vampire mirror, to tell if people who came into the house were vampires. And it came down after a few weeks, when I came home stoned and stumbled into it. Now there's an exposed crack again. It's never going to get fixed.
You don't need to get anyone else. How's your eating? Are you hungry?
Yes, I think. I am going to eat the food my mom made me. I'm still in control of my mind, and I have medication, and I am going to make this happen.
Yes. Good. To the kitchen.
I go in, and the place is all set for me. Dad and my sister, Sarah, are sitting at the circular table, knives and forks in hand, posing for me.
How do we look? Dad asks, banging his silverware on the table. Do we look hungry?
My parents are always looking into new ways to fix me. They've tried acupuncture, yoga, cognitive therapy, relaxation tapes, various kinds of forced exercise, until I found my bike, self-help books, Tai Bo, and feng shui in my room. They've spent a lot of money on me. I'm ashamed.
Eat, 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 Sarah says. We were waiting for you.
Is this necessary? I ask.
We're just making things more homey for you.
Mom brings a baking pan over to the table. It smells hot and juicy. Inside the pan are big orange things cut in half.
We have squash. She turns back to the stove. Rice and chicken.
She brings over a pot of white rice with vegetable bits sprinkled over it, and a plate of chicken patties. I go for them. A star-shaped one, a dinosaur-shaped one. Sarah grabs at the dinosaur-shaped one at the same time.
The dinosaurs are mine!
Okay, I let her. She kicks me under the table.
How are you feeling?
She whispers.
Not good.
She nods. Sarah knows what this means. It means she'll see me on the couch tonight, tossing and turning and sweating as Mom brings me warm milk. It means she'll see me watching TV, but not really watching. Just staring and not laughing as I don't do my homework. It means she'll see me sinking and failing. She reacts well to this. She does more schoolwork and has more fun. She doesn't want to end up like me. At least I'm giving someone an example not to follow.
I'm sorry. They're trying to do a big thing for you.
I can tell.
So, Craig, how was school today?
Dad asks. He forks into the squash and looks at me through his glasses. He's short and wears glasses, but like he says, at least he has hair. Thick, dark stuff that he passed on to me. He tells me I'm blessed. The genes are good on both sides, and if I think I'm depressed now, imagine if I knew I was going to lose my hair like everyone else.
Ha.
All right, I say.
What did you do?
Sat in class and followed instructions. We clink at our food. I take my first bite, a carefully constructed forkful of chicken, rice, and squash, and mash it into my mouth. I will eat this. I chew it and feel that it tastes good and rear my tongue back and send it down. I hold it. All right, it's in there.
What did you do in, let's see, American history?
That one wasn't so good. The teacher called on me and I couldn't talk.
Oh, Craig,
Mom is like. I start constructing another bite. What do you mean you couldn't talk? Dad asks.
I knew the answer, but I just...
You trailed off, Mom says. I nod as I take in the next bite.
Craig, you can't keep doing that.
Honey, Mom tells him.
When you know the answer to something, you have to speak up for yourself. How can that not be clear?
Dad takes in a heaping forkful of squash and chews it like a furnace. Don't jump on him, Mom says.
I'm not. I'm being friendly.
Dad smiles. Craig, you are blessed with a good mind. You just have to have confidence in it and talk when people call on you, like you used to do, back when they had to tell you to stop talking.
It's different now.
Third bite.
We know. Your mother and I know, and we're doing everything we can to help you, right?
He looks across the table at Mom.
Yes.
Me too, Sarah says. I'm doing everything I can too.
That's right.
Mom reaches across to ruffle her hair. You're doing great.
Yesterday I could have smoked pot, but didn't, I say, looking up, curled over my plate.
Craig! Dad snaps.
Let's not talk about this, Mom says.
But you should know. It's important. I'm doing experiments with my mind to see how it got the way it is.
What are you talking about?
Not around your sister,
Mom says. I want to tell you some news about Jordan. Hearing his name, the dog walks into the kitchen, takes up his position by Mom.
I took him to the vet today.
So you didn't go to work?
Right.
And that's why you cooked.
Exactly.
I'm jealous of her. Can you be jealous of your mom for being able to handle things? I couldn't take a day off, take a dog to the vet, and cook dinner. That's like 3 times too much stuff for me to get done in one day. How am I ever going to have my own house?
So, you want to know what happened at the vet?
It's crazy, Sarah says.
We took him in for the seizures he's been having, Mom says, and you'll never believe what the vet said.
What?
They took some blood tests last time, and the results came back. I was sitting in the little room with Jordan. He was being very good. The vet comes in and looks at the papers and says, these numbers are not compatible with life.
I laugh. There's a bite on my fork in front of me. It shakes.
What do you mean?
That's what I asked him. And it turns out that a dog's blood sugar level is supposed to be between 40 and 100. You know what Jordan's is?
What?
9.
Ruff, Jordan barks.
Then... Mom is laughing now. There's some sort of other number, some enzyme ratio level that's supposed to be between 10 and 30, and Jordan's is 180.
Good dog, Dad says.
The vet didn't know what to make of it. He told me to keep giving him the supplements and the vitamins, but that basically he's a medical miracle.
I look over at Jordan, the Tibetan spaniel. Pushed-in shaggy face, black nose, big dark eyes like mine, panting and drooling, resting on his furry front legs.
He shouldn't be alive, but he is, Mom says.
I look at Jordan more. Why are you bothering? You've got an excuse. You've got bad blood. You must like living. I guess I would if I were you. Going from meal to meal and guarding Mom. It's a life. It doesn't involve tests or homework. You don't have to buy things.
Craig,
you shouldn't be able to be alive, and you are. You want to trade?
I guess it's cool.
It's very cool, Mom says. It's by God's grace that this dog lives.
Oh, right, God. Forgot about him. He's definitely, according to Mom, going to have a role in me getting better. But I find God to be an ineffectual shrink.
He adopts the do-nothing method of therapy. You tell him your problems, and he, does nothing.
I'm done, Sarah says. She picks up her plate and trots out of the room, calling to Jordan. He follows.
I can't eat any more either, I say. I've managed 5 bites. My stomach is churning and closing fast.
It's all such inoffensive food. I shouldn't have any problems with it.
I should be able to eat 3 plates of it. I'm a growing boy.
I shouldn't have trouble sleeping. I should be playing sports. I should be making out with girls. I should be finding what I love about this world. I should be frickin' eating and sleeping and drinking and studying and watching TV and being normal.
Try a little more, Craig, Mom says. No pressure, but you should eat.
That's right. I'm going to eat. I slice off the top of the squash in streets and avenues, a big chunk, and put it on my fork and get it in my mouth. I'm going to eat you. I chew it, soft and yielding, easily molded into a shape that fits down my throat. It tastes sweet. Now hold it. It's in my stomach. I'm sweating. The sweating gets worse around my parents. My stomach has it. My stomach is full of 6 bites of this meal. I can take 6 bites. I won't lose it. I won't lose this meal that my mom has made. If the dog can live, I can eat. I hold it. I make a fist. I tense my muscles.
Are you okay?
1 second, I say. I lose. My stomach hitches as I leave the table.
What were you trying to do, soldier?
I was trying to eat, sir.
And what happened?
I got caught thinking about some crap, sir.
What kind of crap?
How I want to live less than my parents' dog.
Are you still concentrated on the enemy, soldier?
I don't think so.
Do you even know who the enemy is?
I think it's me.
That's right.
I have to concentrate on myself.
Yes, but not right now, because now you're going to the bathroom to throw up. It's tough to fight when you're throwing up.
I stumble into the bathroom, turn off the light, close the door. The horrible thing is that I like this part, because when it's over I know I'll be warm. I'll have the warmth in me of a body having just been through a trauma. I bear down on the toilet in the dark. I know just where to go. And my stomach hitches again and slams up at me, and I open up and groan. It comes out, and I hear my mother outside sniffling and my dad muttering, probably holding her. I grip the handle and flush a few times, alternating filling the toilet and flushing it. When I'm done, I'll go to sleep, and I won't do any homework. I'm not up to it tonight. And I think, as I'm down there, the shift is coming. The shift has to be coming. Because if you keep on living like this, you'll die. Part 2. How I Got There. Chapter 7. So why am I depressed? That's the million-dollar question, baby. The Tootsie Roll question. Not even the owl knows the answer to that one. I don't know either. All I know is the chronology. 2 years ago, I got into one of the best high schools in Manhattan, Executive Pre-Professional High School. It's a new school set up to create the leaders of tomorrow. Corporate internships are mandatory. The higher-ups of Merrill Lynch come and speak to classes and distribute travel mugs and stuff. This billionaire philanthropist named Bernard Lutz set it up in conjunction with the public school system, like a school within a school. All you have to do to get in is pass a test. Then your whole high school is paid for, and you have access to 800 of the smartest, most interesting students in the world, not to mention the teachers and visiting dignitaries. You can come out of Executive Pre-Professional High School and go right to Wall Street, although that's not what you should do. What you should do is come out and go to Harvard and then law school. That's how you end up being, like, president. I'll admit it, I kind of want to be president. So this test, they named it the Bernard Lutz Philanthropic Exam, in honor of his philanthropicness, became fairly important in my life. It became more important than, food, for instance. I bought the book for it. Bernard Lutz puts out his own line of test prep books for his own test, and started studying 3 hours a day. I was in seventh grade, and I got comfortable with my room for the first time. I'd come home with my heavy backpack and toss it on the bed, and watch it bounce toward the pillows as I sat down in my chair and pulled out my test prep book. On my cell phone, I would go to Tools Alarm and set myself up for a 2-hour practice exam. There were 5 practice exams in the book, and after I did them all, I was thrilled to discover an ad at the back for 12 more Bernard Lutz test prep books. I went to Barnes & Noble. They didn't have all of them in stock. They'd never had anyone ask for all of them, so they had to put in an order for me. But then it was game on. I started taking a practice exam every day. The questions covered the standard junk that they test you on to determine if you're not an idiot. Reading comprehension. Ooh, can you read this selection and tell what kind of tree they're trying to save? Vocabulary. Did you buy a book full of weird words and learn them? Math. Are you able to turn off your mind to the world and fill it with symbols that follow rules? I made that test my bitch. I mauled the practice exams and slept with the books under my pillow and turned my brain into a fierce machine, a buzzsaw that could handle anything. I could feel myself getting smarter under the light at my desk. I could feel me filling myself. Now, I stopped hanging out with a lot of friends when I got into executive pre-professional mode. I didn't have many friends to begin with. I had the kids who I sat with during lunch, the bare minimum. But once I started carrying flashcards around, they sort of avoided me. I don't know what their problem was. I just wanted to maximize my time. When all of my test prep books were done, I got a personal tutor to shore me up for the exam. She told me halfway through the sessions that I didn't need her, but she kept my mom's $700. I got an 800 on the test out of 800. The day I got those test results, a cold, plaintive, late fall New York day, was my last good day. I've had good moments scattered since then, times when I thought I was better, but that was the last day I felt triumphant. The letter from Executive Pre-Professional High School came in the mail, and Mom had saved it on the kitchen table for me when I got home from Taibo class after school, which was something I intended to keep doing in high school, to have on my extracurricular activity sheet when I applied for college, which would be the next hurdle, the next step. Craig, guess what's here? I threw down my backpack and ran past the vampire mirror to the kitchen. There it was, a manila envelope. The good kind of envelope. If you failed the test, you got a small envelope. If you got in, you got a big one. Yes! I screamed. I tore it open. I took out the purple and gold welcome packet and held it up like the Holy Grail. I could have used it to start my own religion. I could have made, you know, love to it. I kissed it and hugged it until Mom said, "Craig, stop that. That's very sick. How about you call your friends?" She didn't know. Because I never told her that my friends were a bit estranged. They're sort of ancillary anyway, friends. I mean, they're important. Everybody knows that. The TV tells you so. But they come and go. You lose one friend, you pick up another. All you have to do is talk to people. And this was back when I could talk to anybody. My friends, when I had them, pretty much just ragged on me and took my seat when I left the room anyway. Why did I need to call them up? Except Aaron. Aaron was a real friend. I guess I'd call him my best friend. He was one of the oldest guys in my class, born on that cusp where you can be the youngest person in an older class or the oldest in a younger class, and his parents did the right thing and went with the latter. He was smart and fearless, with a flop of brown curly hair and the sort of glasses that made girls like him, square black ones. He had freckles and he talked a lot. When we got together, we would start projects. An alarm clock torn apart and distributed over a wall, a stop-motion video of Lego people having sex, a website for pictures of toilets. I had met him by wandering over to the table during lunch with my head buried in flashcards, sitting down, having one of his friends ask me what I was doing there, and having him come by, flush with tacos, to rescue me, ask what I was studying. It turned out that he and I were taking the same exam, but he wasn't studying at all. Didn't believe in it. He introduced me to the table conversation about what Princess Zelda would be like in bed. I said she'd be terrible, because she'd been locked up in dungeons since puberty, but Aaron said that'd make her super hot. Aaron called me that Friday night. "Want to come over and watch movies?" "Sure." I was done with my practice test for the day. Aaron lived in a small apartment in a big building in downtown Manhattan by City Hall. I took the subway in. My mom had to okay it with Aaron's mom, which was horrifying. identified myself to Aaron's paunchy doorman, and took the elevator up to his floor. Aaron's mom greeted me and brought me into his ventilated chamber.